ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Our phones can feel essential to functioning in everyday life right now. Paying for groceries, scanning QR codes, taking photos, banking. I can't remember the last time I left my phone at home, but I do remember the cold sweat that broke out that time that I lost it for a while. And yet problematic smartphone use is being blamed for an increasing loneliness and stress and anxiety, especially among young people. Researchers are divided on how big a problem this is, but anecdotally, many people say they'd like to stop constantly flitting between apps. Could it be as simple as switching to a less tempting device? Rosa Ellen is a voice that you might have heard here at RN on The Arts Show, and she has been using a dumb phone now for 2 months. Rosa, hi.
Hi, Hilary.
What made you decide to do this? Did you have some kind of pivotal moment where you threw your smartphone in a pond or something?
Yeah, I sort of did.
Oh.
But the moment, I guess the events that led up to it is similar, very similar to what you were just mentioning. It was the flitting. I had this, I'd wake up. The first thing I'd do was check my text messages, check my Messenger app to see who'd messaged me. Then I'd probably move over to my personal email. And then while I was at it, I'd kind of be tempted to check my work email, because why not? Because like in another hour, I was about to, face it anyway. And then maybe Instagram, and then I'd scan, emphasis on scan, the news sites. And then I'd go to work and, as most of us are required to in office jobs, I'd be at my desktop computer for a full 7 to 8 hours. And I was flitting between screens. And the overall, I'm lucky enough that I grew up, I'm a millennial, and I did actually experience some of my early adulthood without a phone at all. By the time I was 30, smartphones were ubiquitous. And I kind of calculated that I'd just spent 10 years on screens. And I had this ultimate feeling that I was wasting my precious life.
Wow. And so you got to this point where you thought something has to change.
Yeah.
What has changed since you de-teched a bit and went to a less smartphone?
It was a slow change. A couple of years ago, I bought a dumb phone, and I'd take my SIM card out of my smartphone on the weekend, and I'd do a bit of a weekend detox, and I'd feel so good afterwards. Like I felt like my neck pain kind of went, and I'd be able to mainly read. I was always a big reader, book reader, and I hated the feeling that I'd have to recalibrate my brain in order to read a still page. And so I was doing that quite a lot. And then gradually, I started to think about how could this be a permanent sort of mode for me. Anyway, over the summer, I was camping and my smartphone broke.
Oh.
Which was the ideal situation, in fact, because then I got out the dumb phone and I was sort of offline. And I feel like there's been some hiccups, but it's been very kind of liberating.
Interesting. Well, tell us about the hiccups, because a lot of people will say, but surely there are many, many things that you can't do and that will be horrific in your daily life. Where have the little stumbling blocks been?
The most egregious stumbling block was on the side of the Westgate Freeway in Melbourne. I had a total meltdown because I didn't
have... It's a terrifying place to be.
I didn't have Google Maps. I'd lost my map reading ability. I got an old Melways, so I supposedly had the map out, but I don't know how to do that anymore. So anyway, that was a big stumbling block. The other thing was I'm not being on WhatsApp messaging app. Now that's where most of my friends sort of, contact each other these days. And so I missed someone's birthday. I sort of fell out of contact with a group of friends that I then had to sort of remedy. So yeah, those things.
Well, yeah, I mean, technically you can open up some of those messaging apps on your laptop later, but it sounds like you have had a kind of wholesale move away from screens. Have you noticed a difference in the way that you spend your time?
Yeah, I had a period where I read like a lot. Like I think I, in the first few weeks I was just getting through a book every day or every couple of days.
Every day?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I was just sort of voracious, and I realised that I'm a bit of a chronic reader, and the phone was the perfect medicine for that. I'd pick up and it didn't really matter what I'd read. It was like reading a cereal box or something. I'd just read what was ever on my phone. And now I was turning to whatever else was within reach, which was like magazines and books. And I have to say that didn't last.
Okay.
Yeah. So that need for sort of entertainment, I sated that, and then I felt a bit bored. And so that was interesting. I'm still in that period. I've been trying to be okay with being bored. And I think that is a bit of a modern conundrum. I've been returning to some hobbies, which include drawing. The number one thing I do feel that has changed in my brain is an ability to concentrate, and I've lost the fear of being out of contact.
That's really interesting, because I wondered if you'd had any anxiety about not being as connected, because I've had these moments where I can't find my phone for a couple of minutes and I freak out. It's like that's really interesting to notice that reaction in myself. But you're saying it's lessened your anxiety overall.
Yeah, it has. That wore off. I mean, people perhaps got a bit used to me being less lightning quick in my responses. People still send me URLs to things. That's very annoying. Or emojis.
How old-fashioned.
Emojis that I can't read. I just guess from the tone of the email.
Can you send me a cat in, like, using punctuation, please?
I still haven't mastered that. That's a lost art.
Do you think that you're going to continue with the dumb phone, Rosa?
Absolutely. I have to come clean about one thing, Hillary. After the Google Maps incident on the Westgate Freeway, I had to find a solution to the fact that I do sometimes need the internet when I'm out and about. And so my solution was I bought a tablet that is Wi-Fi enabled. So sometimes if I'm on a long car trip and I want to listen to a podcast or I need maps, I have that. But I don't take it around with me.
Okay, yeah, it's too big and clunky. Yeah. That's an interesting point. Rosa Ellen, producer of RN's The Art Show, thank you and best of luck.
Thanks.
Fascinating. So is this worth trying for yourself? Jocelyn Brewer is a registered psychologist and runs courses on digital nutrition, which is a philosophy that she developed in her practice. Jocelyn, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you be part of this particular discussion. Mm. And with us too is Brad Ridout, who's an associate professor of cyber psychology at the University of Sydney. Brad, welcome to you.
Hi, Hillary. Great to be here. Looking forward to discussing this very topical topic.
Yes. Well, tell us first, Brad, how do smartphones affect our thinking and about our behaviour? Can we say that they're bad for us overall?
It definitely, anecdotally, especially young people now are identifying that more, that it's increased. They feel like their phones are increasing their stress, anxiety, depression, and even reporting sleep disturbances. And a lot of that can be put down to social media. Social media is the thing that basically draws us in. We spend on average about 5 to 6 hours a day on our smartphone. Probably half of that is on social media, which is way more than people spend, you know, listening to music or podcasts or anything else. So there's a whole heap of reasons why. FOMO is one of the big ones, and just feeling like they need to be connected all day long. And there's just so many things about the social media apps on the smartphone, the notifications probably being the most obvious one, that constantly, you know, are trying to draw us out of our everyday offline life and back into the online life. So, yeah, that can definitely be very stressful and an absolute constant distraction where people are actually, you know, reporting something we're calling variable attention stimulus trait, which is kind of like a culturally induced ADHD.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really starting to affect people's brains in ways that our brains just aren't designed to cope with.
Well, and as you say, you know, those apps and those phones are designed to be sticky and distracting. I was fascinated to hear that Rosa was having less difficulty concentrating now that she's using a so-called dumb phone. And Brad, they affect our cortisol levels too, don't they? I mean, you talked about some of the things that we look at on our phones that aren't great for us, but also the ways we use them. Do they affect our brain chemistry?
The research is yet to kind of determine that scientifically, but we're definitely seeing that doing certain habits like checking work emails, first thing in the morning, as Rosa said, or, you know, last thing at night, can lead to a stress that we're just not used to having and interfere with those natural cortisol rhythms, not to mention our sleep, obviously. The blue light that phones emit affects our sleep and reduces melatonin, which helps us get to sleep. So there are things that you can do. I think most people these days are aware of the night mode and things like that. They can put it in their phone to reduce that. But just not having that switch off that our brains are and usually wired to need in order to get quality sleep can definitely have an impact. But there are things like the addictive design that kind of, you know, just give us little bursts of stress throughout the day that we're not used to having. We're you know, evolved to be able to concentrate on a few things at a time, not 100 things at a time. It's like our brains are used to, as Rosa said, having multiple tabs open in our life. And it's not just when you're sitting down at a computer, it's everywhere, because you know your phone is just that whole world in your pocket, and it's constantly beeping at you and wanting your attention. And yeah, it can definitely give you that feeling of stress throughout the day, not to mention the stress of FOMO if you choose to take a break from it.
Yeah, though it can also tell you who that actor was in that weird, obscure 70s film that you really, really need to know at this particular point in time. We're speaking with Brad Ridout, who's an Associate Professor of Cyber Psychology at the University of Sydney, and Jocelyn Brewer, who's a registered psychologist and runs courses on digital nutrition. Jocelyn, from that perspective, what do you think about the dumb phone trend as an antidote to that kind of stress?
I think it's a lovely use of nostalgia. I think we all have that sense of, you know, the evolution of our own use of phones and that slippery slope where, you know, our grasp on attention has really, you know, flitted away and dissolved over probably the last 10 to 15 years. Look, the dumb phone is, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, that's just another way to make money. when we can remove apps, I guess, from our smartphone that are the more distracting ones without losing the convenience. So Rosa, for instance, might just want to remove some of the apps that she does find really tricky to avoid. I personally delete Instagram off my phone from Monday morning to Thursday night, and then I use it over the weekend so I can have that sense of connection with my friends. It sounds too, though, what I thought was really interesting is that Rosa's found JOMO, the joy of missing out, which is something that Christina Crook talks about. So the antidote to FOMO, the fear of missing out, is actually that sense of realizing there's not that much going on, that picking up the phone or, you know, using some of those other, oh my gosh, old school ways, turning up to somebody's house and just knocking on the door. Remember when we used to do that? Could actually, yeah, replace. So very interesting kind of way that we're all adapting to recognizing this massive information overload that we're experiencing.
Though most people I know react with horror to the idea that people might just turn up unannounced at their house on a Sunday and knock on the door. What?
Or call you, right? Like the idea that we used to have one device that could ring at any moment and there could be anyone on the other side. Was actually used to be really exciting.
Yes, yeah, that was really interesting. Like, a couple of questions come up for me, Jocelyn, in what you've said. I mean, could it put us at a social disadvantage if we don't have that connectability? Rosa was saying, you know, she had to rebuild some friendships at various points when people thought, well, she's not getting back to me, this is bad.
Absolutely. That's a key thing that people report, is that feeling literally of missing out. And FOMO, I reframe often, it's used sort of to make us feel bad for wanting to belong. And belonging and feeling connected is actually a really hardwired part of human experience. So what I suggest people do when they do need to take a little bit of a break, or they need to kind of readjust their relationship to technology and that, you know, urgency response, is to communicate with people exactly what their changes are. Like, hey, I really value our friendship, but I'm not going to be on 17 different apps where you can send me memes at all hours of the day or night. We actually need to find a different, you know, older, maybe going backwards to some degree, way to communicate and keep our connections alive. So usually I've got a list of friends actually that are not on social media that I make sure that I'm texting and that I'm kind of including in different ways so that I don't lose that contact, but it takes a bit of effort.
Yeah, I had friends who lived overseas that I would only email before smartphones, and that's kind of died now because there are messaging apps that are cheaper and you can talk to people overseas, and I missed that really, that long form communication. But Jocelyn, yeah. The other thing that occurred to me when you were talking about ways to cut back was that that's really hard, that moderation approach. You know, you can delete apps, but you often reinstate them. You might turn off notifications and then wonder what's going on. Is that going to work for people, or do you need to kind of go cold turkey in a sense?
Look, it's horses for courses. There are different personality styles that work better with a complete abstinence approach, and to those people, I salute you. I am much more about that moderation. What we see from the digital detox kind of research is that people can swear off things, they unplug, they go on these really hectic kind of digital diets or yo-yo diets. And because there's that disconnection, which is kind of too overwhelming, people then tend to come back online and binge. So the digital nutrition approach is really about taking stock of how we're feeling and noticing really the physiological responses. Like Brad was saying, that you can almost feel the cortisol and the amygdala hijack that happens when we get overloaded with too much information, as well as the dopamine response of all the rewards of being online as well. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's a one-size-fits-one, and really looking at your own digital diet and thinking about what things are nourishing and feel good to you is really, really important. I talk about the idea that some online activities are kind of like highly processed foods and some are the digital kale, and sitting down and actually considering what things are useful and feel good that have virtual vitamins in them. That's a little activity I do with students that I work with to actually kind of come up with what are these virtual vitamins, then what are the additives and the highly processed kind of foods of the online world.
Well, and I love how you talk about the practical things like putting on your digital sunscreen, dealing with your timers and things, being a bit mindful about your use, but also checking in with your responses about whether you feel that things are going well with your use, but also being aware of whether it aligns with your values. And that's really interesting, isn't it? When some of us look at how we're using our devices and work out that it's not how we want to be living our lives and conducting our relationships, isn't it, Jocelyn?
Yeah, that's right. So I talk about the three M's of digital nutrition, which is kind of like apply before scrolling. Before we go out into the sun, we put our sun cream on. Before you go scrolling, I suggest you put the three M's on. And one of the three M's is to have meaning in what you're actually consuming. So, you know, my personal example, I did a big cull of who I was following a couple of weeks ago, and I noticed I was following not one but two dudes who mow lawns and do whippersnippering. And I just had to be like, that was fun for about three videos, but now it's actually just a massive distraction and is taking me away from the stuff that really matters.
Yep.
So, yeah, just kind of doing a bit of a cull, realigning to the stuff that's meaningful is really helpful. Being mindful is one of the other M's, and then moderate is the third. So little ways that we can use the technology under our skull to kind of override the very powerful and ubiquitous and, you know, compelling technology in our pocket.
Oh, I'm a bit sad that I might have to stop watching my Japanese competitive bed making videos because they're very calming, but sure, I'll take that on board.
In moderation.
Exactly. We're speaking with Jocelyn Brewer, who's a registered psychologist specialising in digital nutrition, and Brad Ridout, who's an associate professor of cyber psychology at the University of Sydney. And Brad, interesting to note that there was this big uptick in search results for dumb phones over the last few years, but not a lot of uptake. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think that speaks to what Jocelyn was saying about digital detoxes. That kind of was all the rage maybe 5 years ago, and, you know, many people have tried it and realized that it doesn't really work. They do find that people come back and end up binging to catch up on what they missed. So yeah, I can see why there's an interest in that. A lot of pro dumb phone people are not calling them dumb phones, they're calling them intentional phones. So there's phones that, you know, are not just like the old brick or flip phone. There's something called the Lite Phone 2, which actually has a GPS map app on it. It allows you to listen to music and have podcasts and, you know, take notes and all those kind of productive digital vitamins, I guess, things that actually give you meaning. And, you know, if you could pair back your smartphone, those are the things you'd keep. We're not really seeing a huge uptake. You know, the latest stats show us that half of the Australian dumb phone users are simply people over 65 who never really took to smartphones, or just, you know, find them just not really for them. So,
although I thought it was interesting to note too that they also are possibly making a canny choice about battery life and cost, because those things are cheaper.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. That's one of the big advantages is battery life. How often do people have to be out and about and quickly search for, you know, has anyone got a charger? You know, vending machines selling chargers these days. But I do think that being more mindful about your smartphone use is the way to go. And the digital nutrition approach is the one that we definitely recommend. And I think that one of the biggest things is simply taking out your phone at an idle moment. That's something, you know, we find that people pick up their phone about 100 times a day on average, which when you consider the amount of waking hours, that's, you know, every 10 or 15 minutes. So the best way to break a habit is to replace it with another one. So if you can think of something else to do in those moments where you're, you know, queuing in line or waiting for your coffee, you know, take 10 deep breaths to just, you know, recenter yourself and be aware of your surroundings. Think of something else you can do, because focusing on don't pick up the phone, it's like don't think of a white elephant. It's not really the best way to go about it. The one I always come back to is taking notifications off your phone for things that you don't need to be notified about, because that's once again the thing that draws you in when you don't really need to be.
Yeah. So a friend of mine suggests if you're waiting in a queue, do your pelvic floor exercises, because otherwise you get to the end of the day and think, why did I not have 10 minutes to do that?
That's a great one as well. Yeah.
Yep.
So just I like to play a game called What Did We Do in 1997? That's my favorite game to play, because all of these things that we come up against, we kind of got through in life not that long ago.
That's really interesting. We did a story recently about hanging out and how people used to hang out with each other and talk and watch other people go past. And what a lovely time that was for many of us. Look, it's been fascinating looking at some of the ways that people are trying to take back that control over their attention spans and their lives and their connectivity. Thank you both so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary.
Jocelyn. Thank you. Jocelyn Brewer is a registered psychologist. She specialises in digital nutrition. And Brad Ridout is Associate Professor of Cyber Psychology at the University of Sydney.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.